prayer. O Holy Spirit, come and enlighten our hearts and our minds. Help us to hear and know what it is that you are saying to each one of us through this passage. What you want us to know and do. Amen. Well, here's the setting that we've been visiting. Last week we had a very spectacular passage about the Transfiguration, where Jesus is revealed as something more than what they thought he was. They began to realize what it meant for him to be the Christ, the Messiah, the Anointed One. You see, before that, he asks Peter and the disciples, who do other people say I am? And they say, well, you're one of the prophets, Elijah maybe, and John the Baptist. But he finally says to them, well, who do you say I am? And Peter says, well, you are the Christ. You are the Son of God. You are the Anointed One who is to come and bring salvation, like, you know, from the prophets of old. And Jesus says, right. And then he says, I'm going to go and die. And I'll be resurrected from the dead after 3 days. And Peter says, what? Do you think he really understood who Jesus was? The answer is absolutely not. And he says to Jesus, stop the crazy talk. He doesn't use those particular words. But he rebukes Jesus. He says, don't talk like that. Whatever it was got him upset. This is not the kind of Messiah. This is not the kind of Christos, Christ, that I want. And Jesus then turns on him, to him and says, after saying, well, this is only revealed to you by the Holy Spirit, he says to him, get behind me, Satan. And again, just to clarify, Satan is not the devil, the horns and stuff like this, or the evil spirit that infested the snake in the Garden of Eden. When the word Satan is used here, it means adversary. You who oppose the ways of God. Which is why Satan is called Satan. Because he opposes the rule, the kingdom, the paradise of God. He's the destroyer. And he says to Peter, you oppose the ways of God. This is the way God chooses to do it. I have to do this. And subsequent to that, we then have the scene of the Transfiguration, which then, in where Jesus brings his closest disciples, James, John, and Peter, up the mountain, and it is revealed that he is with Moses and Elijah, the heroes of faith, and he himself is transfigured, transformed. Something about him is revealed. And Mark, being the simplest of all the Gospels, just says, he shone whiter than white. Like, what? He didn't have the words. That's all he knew to say. He was whiter than white. We're not talking about race or ethnicity. But his clothes glowed a particular color. Or beyond color. And the disciples began to see who Jesus was. Do you think they understood, though? I'm not quite sure. I think they're still trying to say, what? He's not just another prophet. He's much, much more. So they come down from the mountain, and Mark just brings us to this particular passage. The other disciples, it seems, and we don't know if it's like how far later, but it seems like the other disciples there, they come down from this vision, this transformation of Jesus, where he's revealed as more than merely a man, but God. And the other disciples are arguing with the scribes. And they come up to them and say, well, oh, what's going on here? Why are you guys arguing? The scribes were, you know, a sect of people who kind of knew their Bible stuff, or the intellectuals of the Bible. They kept the rules and they clarified them and stuff like this. They were the teachers of the law. And they started to have, they were having this row. They were always opposed to Jesus during this time, a good majority of them. And they began to have this argument, so was it back at the same thing? So Jesus simply asked, well, okay, what's going on? A man in the crowd says, my son is sick. He has a demon in him. It says, it takes away his speech, and we also know it takes away his hearing. So he's completely closed off. That's what we know. And it throws him on the ground, he foams at the mouth, he gnashes his teeth, becomes rigid. It sounds like he's got epilepsy. But is that all it is? Is it just a physiological condition? Well, Jesus has something to say. He says, you are an unbelieving generation. Now, I'd like to see who he's actually talking to, but we're not exactly told. Is he talking to the scribes? Is he talking to his disciples that were left behind? Or is he talking to this man? Did he say that because they couldn't cast out the demon? Did he call them an unbelieving generation simply because they're arguing? What does unbelief or faithlessness mean? Why does he say you're faithless? That you're unbelieving? Is it because they didn't believe in him? What is belief? Well, what does it mean to believe? I'm going to just touch this briefly. I'm not going to answer the question, but it's something you have to ask yourself. What does it mean for you to believe? You know, we have the example of the chair and the kids. But isn't that a lot of Christians? Even our own selves sometimes? So we believe in Jesus. But what does it really mean? How do I live this? So belief, we know, is not merely intellectual assent. Right? Sure, I believe the chair is going to hold my weight. So what? I know that. You know, the sun's going to shine tomorrow. You know, or it's, if it doesn't, there'll be clouds that's behind the clouds. You know, I know that. That's fact, right? It's in my head. What do I do? Is that all it means to believe? It's not. This is not what Jesus means. It does not mean merely hoping. Hoping something will happen. You know, like The Secret. You hear The Secret? That book? That if you just want it enough, you really just, it'll happen to you. It will happen. Oh yes, I'm going to make $1 million. I'll be rich. Or you know who got rich? The guy who wrote the book. I bet you he was wishing for popularity in his life. Well, I guess it came to be. And there's many people, even friends that I know, who deeply believe in this kind of belief in the self. That you can make things happen only by hoping that it will. Is this what it means in the Bible? No, it's not. It's not what belief is. And it's not going through the motions of faith and religion. There's supposed to be 2 billion Christians on the planet. 2 billion. That's a lot. Yay, we win because we're the biggest religion in the world. Is that what it is? No, it's not. There are people who call themselves Christians who are doing things that are as pagan as your animists. And I will go as far as to say that there are people from animist cultures who are doing things that are closer to true faith in God. They may not know his name. They may not know Jesus. But they're close. Closer than those who may call themselves Christians. I was being told that someone had... There was this practice among certain Catholic groups, and Catholicism being the largest of all the Christian sects or denominations, where they will literally... I don't know, maybe it's a tradition or something, that they burn, they melt wax limbs as a way of asking God for healing. How is that different from the tribal bush person who carves a little god and asks for healing. How is it different from praying to Gunyam, or one of the Chinese ancestral? It's not different. Does that person believe in Jesus? So what is true faith? This passage will reveal it to us. Not merely intellectual assent, not merely hoping, not just going through some kind of motions of religious practice. I wonder, actually, now, what was the father doing when these scribes and the disciples of this Jesus, who everyone knew was a healer, when they were arguing, where was he? Lost in the crowd. While the smart people or the involved people are having their adult conversation. Well, Jesus asks the question, what's going on? And he is the first one to answer. Do you think maybe he's just sick and tired of being sidelined by these people, by the disciples and by the scribes, that they ended up ignoring him? Is that where Jesus is speaking to when he says, you are a faithless generation. You're an unbelieving generation. You left this man by the sidelines to have your little religious chat. But he's the first one who answers when Jesus says, why are you guys arguing? He's not involved in the argument. He's the subject of the argument. His son is. And Jesus begins to have a conversation with him. The first thing Jesus says, how long has this been going on? Just since childhood. It's been a lifetime. And I wonder if the father is simply losing hope. He says to Jesus, if you are able, have pity on us. If you can, help us. Take pity on us. The Greek word is actually not just can. The Greek word is dunamai. It's related to aspects of power, or dunasai. Dunasai is the word, or is the form of the Greek word. It means to have power. So the word ability is in question. Does Jesus have the ability? And the man is saying, if you have the power, if you have the ability, and if you have pity on us. And Jesus replies, if I have the power, or if I can, in some of our translations, but he's meaning, if I have dunasai, I have the power. I always wonder, because sometimes it's not like I'm reading a modern novel that tells you, and then Jesus said in a very grave tone, can I? Or Jesus said, his eyes, turning hard, can I? You know what I mean? It doesn't tell you the tone of his voice, and I always wish that the Bible would do that. One day we'll ask the man, maybe. But it just gives us the words, if I can, if I have the power. Is he indignant? If I can? What are you talking about, Willis? Or is he questioning? If I can? And where's the emphasis? Is it on the ability? If I can? Or if I can? If I can, I think the passage reveals to us which tone it actually is. Stay with me here. Jesus replies, everything is dunata. Dunasai, same word. Dunata. Everything is possible, able, for the one who believes, for a person who believes. If you are reading that properly, his answer is not, if I have the power, are you questioning me? If I have the power, is actually the tone. Because he then flips it around. He says, everything is able for the person who believes. It's kind of weird when we come to healings. Because a lot of people talk about like, well, do you have the faith to believe that you're healed? Jesus often asks, do you believe? But what does it mean to believe? He says to this man comes to him and says, if you can and have pity on us, help us. Jesus says, if I can, do you know it's possible? Do you know the ability lies upon the belief of a person? But what does he mean by belief? That the man hopes that Jesus can? That there's some kind of intellectual assent that Jesus can? Is that what it is? And we sort of said, well, that's not really the meaning. So what does he mean when he says to him, it's possible for the one who believes? The emphasis is not on his own ability. I think Jesus is pretty secure. I mean, he's literally going to die. And he chooses it himself to start moving towards Jerusalem. From the point of transfiguration, from the point of Peter's confession, he says, now that you know who I am, or you think you know who I am, I'm going to show you who I am. I'm the one who knows what I have to do. He turns the table on this man, and it's not about himself. He doesn't focus on his ability, but he says he focuses on the ability of that person to believe. The ability is somehow related to the one who believes. But it is a specific belief. What is it that he is supposed to put faith in? What is it that he is exactly to believe? I don't know if I have the picture here. This is where it gets really interesting. You thought it was interesting now. I'm just scratching the surface. If you just read this passage, oh yeah, Jesus, like, you know, he's kind of posing. It's a very simple conversation. Think about it. There's a lot more going on here than at first blush. The man cries out, we're told in the text, I believe, help my unbelief. But if you really read the text in the Greek, and I wish Ben were here because he can verify, the Greek says, with tears. There is a word that means to call out. But there's another word here that says his eyes were filled with tears. And we miss that in some of our translations. Because what does it tell us? It tells us his tone. It tells us how he's saying these things. He's crying. So this is the heart of the matter. Belief and doubt live together. Not apart. Not in this life. Actually, I would go as far as to say that true belief is born of doubt. Let me put it this way. If you never ask a question, you will never know the answer. And if you don't ask the hard questions, you won't know the answers to that. If you do not face the darkness, you will never overcome it. if you simply avoid pain and hard questions in faith, and you will only allow it to grow in the recesses of your mind and of your heart. You will simply never grow in your understanding of God, of Jesus, of the work of the Holy Spirit. Take this man. His son has been being destroyed by a demon his entire life. He throws him into the fire to burn his body. He throws him into the water to drown him. Is this mere epilepsy? Is he sitting by the fire and suddenly has a seizure? I know people with epilepsy. Maybe this is what it is. But whatever it is that plagues this boy, is it merely just a medical condition? That's a good question, isn't it? But do you think this father, who knows there is a demon in his son, seeking to destroy him, sat idly all those years? Oh, there's Bobby again, falling into the well. There's Bobby again, falling into the furnace, into the oven. No, of course not. He didn't sit out. I think if you were a friend of someone, if you were a parent, you know you will do anything. Anything, even give your own life to make your child well again. You would go to the ends of the earth. Do you think he never questioned God? That he'd sit next to his son while he's convulsing and say, "Where are you, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? Why is this happening to my son?" How close have you ever been to suffering? Not necessarily someone else's, although that's possible. But how about your own? This father is stuck. Stuck in his pain. Stuck in his doubt. And yet in desperation for all that he suffers, all that his son suffers. See, the hard thing is that if it was just him, I think, it wouldn't be as bad. But it's his son. When someone you love suffers, is broken, is bound, it hurts that much more. And he says, maybe the disciples of Jesus can help me. I don't know where Jesus is now. He's gone off somewhere to be transfigured, of course, which we know. He says, maybe these guys can help me. And so they try, but they can't do a thing. And the scribes are there going, "Ha, look at that. It doesn't work." And I'm sure the disciples are like, "Whoa, come on now." And they get into this argument. He's just standing there like, "Great. I'm looking for help." And these guys get into an argument. How long have you suffered? Or have you kind of put that aside? How long have you asked the questions without any answers? If you don't ask, our world is asking. I guarantee you, our world is asking. Where is God? Will I be alone and feel alone forever in this marriage, in my singleness, in this relationship that's going round and round in circles? Does anyone really care about me? when I'm sitting by myself, alone in my own thoughts? Does anyone even want to hear my cries? Because when I do, they look down on me. When I vent my anger at people who have done me wrong, I'm told simply to forgive them. When I want to destroy them, and I'm just told I'm being a bad person. I'm not loved in my anger, I'm not loved in my fear. How long will my relationship with my parents be strained? How long do I have to hide my true feelings? What about my relationships that are broken with my friends, my family, my exes? What about this disease in my body that doesn't go away? What about the cancer? What about the injustice? What about the child soldiers? What about the environment in its decay? Jesus, do you really have the power? Do you really have the pity to deliver me? These are the real questions. If we don't ask them here together as God's people, where do you have to go? And this is what this man is asking. Do you have the power? Do you have the compassion, Jesus, to deliver my son from the demon that robs him of everything? I wonder if he says to God in some way, do you know how it feels to never hear the words, I love you, Father? Because this man has never heard those words. I don't know, maybe he's in the Chinese culture. Hey, they don't say that stuff anyways. But that cuts pretty close, doesn't it? To never hear that you're loved, that you're worth anything. What does that do to someone? What kind of pain is that? I'm not talking about the Father, I'm talking about us. To have parents that never say from the bottom of my heart, I love you and I will give my life for you. You know how many of us sit in this world or live in this world broken by that reality? If your parents have said to you, I love you, and if they show it, and if you know they mean it, you are unusual. You are blessed beyond all measure. And you carry with you a treasure that will allow you to soar. But many more people, by the vast, vast majority, are given words that are like anchors that sink them into the depths of the sea. Words that they will never hear, have no hope of hearing, that they long for their entire life. This man will never hear, and yet he hopes that he will hear his son say, I love you, Daddy. To embrace him without convulsing, without foaming at the mouth, without having to worry. Doubt, rightly spoken, rightly exposed, rightly confessed, brought into the light, lets the light in. It's the possibility. It's the dunasai, the dunata, the power, the ability of faith, of life, of Jesus that comes in. The one who protects himself, never risking to bear the naked soul, will never truly live. Even the non-Christian Greek philosophers know this. The life unexamined is not worth living because you strip it of its meaning when you don't look. And I dare say that a person who does not look, who does not strip their soul, will not only not live, but never truly believe. Jesus has got to make this quick. Because the crowds are starting to show. He's having this chit-chat with this fellow. This guy is crying. This man is crying. His son is there. And the crowds say, hey, Jesus is there again. And you know he's been running from the crowds. If you read the Mark in passage. He can't even get into a house. He can't go to a village. And so he quickly does what he has to do. He speaks to the evil spirit. And this is how we then know, because it shrieks. There is something more than what is physically wrong. It convulses violently when it's addressed. And it comes out. Now, this is something I want to make very clear. If you're dealing with a demon, no degree or amount of therapy or medication will ever help them. But if a person actually has a physiological issue or a psychological issue, they need medicine and therapy and not demon exorcism. So I'm going to say it real quick. Don't just think everything's a demon. And don't just think that medication and therapy are the everything. You need people who are wise in both ways to be able to discern whether it's a spirit or whether it's a physiological issue. Sometimes it can be both. That's complicated. But just giving you a heads up on this. But this is real. But in this case, it was a demon. And Jesus knows that. He addresses the demon, casts it out, and casts it out forever. He says, I don't want to see you back here again. You come out, and you never come back. And the boy falls down like a dead person. Now I'm sure that father's a little worried. But get this. Jesus, it says, takes the boy by the hand and raises him up. There's no mistaking the language. There's a resurrection in this boy's life. I'm not saying he died, but the imagery is all there. And the way in which Jesus does it. Taking this young man by the hand and lifting him up. Unbelievable. Yes. And that is the point. But what about you? Are you willing to face your doubts? Your fears, your pain. I don't want to push you, but I do have to ask you. And if that feels like pushing, do that. Because it's an invitation to be free. And I cannot, for the life of me, not say the words, consider. What it means to be free. Yes, we have freedom in Christ. Yes, we're coming to know Him. Yes, we have come to faith in Him. But what does it mean to truly believe in Jesus? Well, you are seeing in this passage the reality of what it means. Transformation, resurrection, redemption, a complete turnaround, a change. Anything short of that, well, isn't really a miracle. Because you can manufacture that yourself. So, faith and doubt, I have a question. I'm going to hand out something to you as a part of this exercise. So if you can take a piece of paper, that'll be really good. It'll be extras because I need a lot. If you need a pen or a pencil, please let me know and I'll toss you one. This is the question I want you to answer. What do you long to believe, whoops, me in the way, but have trouble believing? There you go. Pencil. Give you the nice ones first. There you go. Good catch. Oh, sorry. I overthrew that. My mistake. Anyone else? I'm not going to risk another toss. Before you fill this out, I want you to really think long and hard. This is not a simple exercise. Okay. I know how hard this can be. But I'm just going to ask you to be honest. And I want you to do it anonymously. I don't want you to put your name on it or any marks on it that will identify you. And what I'm going to ask you to do with this is I want you to honestly, if you can, okay? I'm not pushing. I'm just asking, okay? Put it down. And I'm going to ask you to lay it at the foot of the cross. And then, so move these things around a bit. And as you do so, and don't do it lightly. I mean, if you can't today, don't worry about it. I don't want to say, I've got to do it because Pastor Ted told me. No. If you're not ready, it's okay. Keep the piece of paper for yourself then. Write it down if you want to or not. But take it if you really want to believe this. If you want to lay this stuff there, I'm going to ask you to put it at the foot of the cross. And totally anonymously, I'm going to read them. So don't include any names in particular. But you know the names if there's people involved. If it's your father, your mother, your brother, your sister, your friend, your husband, your wife, your child, yourself. And in doing so, it is an act of faith that was hidden will come to light. Let me know if you need an extra piece of paper or something. That's all that. And Jesus asked by the disciples a very specific and pointed question. Why couldn't we cast out the demon? I mean, you sent us out on these mission programs, the sending of the 12, the sending of the 70. We did these things. We cast out demons. We preached the good news of the kingdom. But for this boy, why couldn't we? Jesus seems to give a very cryptic reply, saying this kind of demon can only come out by prayer. Actually, the better translation from the Greek would be, these, or this type, can never come out, if there is no prayer. Literally. No prayer, no redemption. Why? Well, this is part of the secret of this passage. It's actually not a secret, it's an open secret, you know? If you can find it, it's there. Because our whole time here this morning has been to ask the question, what does it mean to believe? What does it mean to have faith? Because Jesus comes down and says, you are a faithless, an unbelieving generation. And then he says, all things are possible for the one who believes. And the man's reply is, I believe, help my unbelief. We already said that it's not intellectual assent. We said it's not merely hoping. It's not merely religious action. The answer is actually here. Faith is in the way of living. And therefore a way of thinking, of feeling, of acting. It isn't an idea. It is tangible. A person who believes in Jesus, in God, lives a certain way. Let me say that again. A person who believes in Jesus, in God, lives a certain way. We are mistaken when we say, only God knows if a person is saved. That's a lie. The world can tell if you are of God or not by the way that you live. And the world can tell if a Christian really follows the teachings of Jesus or not. So why do we say that we cannot tell, that we cannot judge? When Paul writes very clearly that we will judge the angels themselves. By the way you treat people and talk to them. By the wisdom you show. By the honesty, transparency, and authenticity of your life. By the way you forgive those who wrong you or frustrate you or disappoint you. And let me say this clearly. Yes, you're supposed to get angry, sad, mad, frustrated, confused. And yes, you will say things you may not want to say, but that's what you feel. And you have to say them because you can't bury them anymore. But you will still forgive. You will still trust. You are filled with grace. Jesus is not for repression. Repression. If you are angry, you are angry. If you're frustrated, you're frustrated. If you're tired, you're tired. Jesus gets that. Those are not wrong. Those are not non-Christian. But at the end of the day, what do you do? All this belief in God begins and ends with one thing. Without prayer, nothing changes. The depth of your faith, of your belief, is not how much you know or how much you do for Jesus. It's how much time you spend with Him. And I'm not talking about the minutes or the number of words you speak. The reality of your faith is measured by how you pray. And let me teach you the truest forms of prayer. For true prayer is simply and often authentically coming to God and spilling your guts. Telling Him everything that is on your mind. Everything. From the nastiest thought to the purest. And pouring it out at His feet. To come with Him with tears in your eyes, weeping and saying, I believe. Help my unbelief. I have faith. But help me because I am also faithless. Like the man in the story, the tears in his eyes, the pain in his heart, the yearning, the frustration, the desperation, the passion that is there. Jesus, I trust You. Help me trust You more. And that is what you're invited to. Prayer. We are told that prayer transforms everything. But do you really believe that? You'll find out. Someone very wise once said, that prayer is the only action for which there is no replacement. But we act in a world, even a Christianized world, in which prayer is dismissed as just devotion. Is that all it is? A religious practice? No. Faith comes by prayer, and prayer nurtures faith, and it makes things real. It's not a hocus-pocus kind of thing. You don't get everything we want right away. I wish we did. There are certain pains that we will always live with. But to know God goes with us through the darkness and through the light. That's where faith resides. I'm a little at a loss as to what to do with these. I like to read them, but they're hot to the touch, so to speak. If you like, I'm going to do it this way instead. Because we're a community. I'm going to ask you, in all your belief and unbelief, to take someone else's. To pray for them this week. Would you do that? You don't know who it is. But whatever's written here, pray with all your heart for them. That's a risk, isn't it? Because we have to believe in this community. So when, yeah.
I think that might.
Oh, did I not make that clear? Do you want me to read it? Did you understand I was going to read it either out loud? Okay. In that case, if I had not made that clear, thank you for that. I will read it. And I will pray for you. Thank you for that. Because it wasn't clear. All your private thoughts here then, I will read privately. And I will pray for you. But I will encourage you to, if you can, at some point in your life, share this with people in this community. It's one thing for me as a pastor to know. I'll share with you mine then. Because I think because I'll be praying for myself. It's kind of weird. You can pray for me. You can pray for me. Oh, trade. Okay, fair trade. I can pray for all these and then you pray for all yours.